I share with you my story, would you share your...
You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN Radio. Hi, I'm John Williams. I go 9 to noon, and then Pete Zimmerman puts together a pretty good business lunch for you, and I think he's got another good one lined up today. Ian Schur, the editor-at-large at CNET, will say hi to us, and Amy Guth will join us, the business reporter, a little later on. Among the things Amy is talking about, the percentage of people in this country who are not buying food because they don't have the money, the percentage of people who are not getting food right now because they don't have the money. I live not too far from Wrigley Field, which is now a station for food distribution twice a week. And sometimes I forget that they do that there, say on a Saturday, if I happen to be driving by, and I'll notice a line of cars in front of Wrigley Field along Waveland Avenue, and then a line of cars parked along the next block heading towards Halsted as you go east, and then the next block. And as you drive by, you see families of all colors, sizes, and descriptions driving cars, some which are old and rusted and some of which are brand new, and they all have something in common. They need free food. We'll talk about that with Amy Guth at 12:45 here on WGN Radio. I told you a little while ago, just one other business note here, and it'll, I think, lend itself to what Ian has to talk to us about. I wanted to buy an iPad the other day. Ours conked out. Obviously, we'd like to get a new one. The Apple stores are closed. The Best Buys are open. I went to the Best Buy, but now they were all boarded up because of the violence. A lot of the stores have limited how you can shop them. Obviously, it's been the law because of COVID. But the violence literally caused them to screw plywood into the fronts of the stores. My Best Buy was closed. And I was a little frustrated. I drove around town looking for it and couldn't get into any of them. They were all closed up. Somebody reminded me that the store I was going to on North Elston had been looted three times. So my problems are small, and our hope is that everybody's going to be able to get back to business. Ian Schur is on a phone line, the editor-at-large over at CNET. So then folks reminded me, Ian, they said, well, you can just buy them online and have it shipped to you, but I'm the kind of guy who, if I'm going to spend $600 on something, I want to look at it, touch it, talk to somebody about it, because I don't know which bell and whistle I need. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and you're not alone. A lot of people want that, which is why Apple has actually, when they opened their stores after the reopening started around the coronavirus, they said that they were going to focus a lot on making sure there was kind of one-on-one interaction between the employees and the customers, and they weren't going to just let the stores fill up. And I think that that's part of why, you know, they realized that people want that. But now with the stores closed again, at least in major cities, it's becoming quite a tough thing. And, I mean, it's an issue all over the place, right? Retail in general is really affected by when looting happens and whatnot. But Apple may be more than most because it is a real magnet in a lot of places. You know, before all this coronavirus and before the unrest, I would walk past an Apple store and the mall could be empty, but it would be full. And I think that now, you know, people are forced to go online or wait.
Yeah, and that's kind of where I am right now. I guess I'll do it online and takes my chances. Literally, I want to get the biggest screen. And they talk about, what is it, the optical distance or the lens, iris distance. There's some fancy phrase they use to describe the size of the screen. And I want to know...
It's actually more than that. So what it is it's about the distance from the screen and the density of the screen. So if the screen has a really high resolution, right, super duper sharp, how far away can you hold the screen where you aren't able to actually see what the pixels are? And that is something, they have a different terms all over the tech industry for it, but that is the term that really is you're looking for. And you know, good news is that most devices these days have what Apple calls a retina display, where
retina,
it's essentially
that's it.
You're not going to be able to see on correctly rendered stuff like text. You won't be able to see the pixels when you're looking at it from a normal distance.
Let's pick it up in just a minute with what Facebook is doing. They've got a feature that lets you archive or trash old embarrassing posts. Does this mean, Ian, that forever nobody will gain access to them? I think we could all use a little bit of that. We'll pick it up there in a minute. If I go to my camera phone, the camera on my phone, and then hit the pictures, I can find a picture of the Mars cheese sign. the giant Mars cheese sign. And it says above there, they could say anything they want, but they've got the big Mars cheese. "I can't breathe" are the words that are illuminated for everybody going to Wisconsin to see. Interesting, huh, how they are getting engaged that way. Ian Schur joins us, editor-at-large at CNET. Ian, you were talking to us a moment ago about something going on with Facebook. How is this new? I thought you could already archive or trash permanently old photographs or posts that you didn't want people to see, no?
You are correct. You could. There was a setting in Facebook that if you went in there, and we have instructions on CNET, of course, what it would do is it would basically say, okay, everything that you've posted up until now will be made friends only or only available to you or deleted entirely. But what Facebook didn't do until now is that they haven't made it so that you can choose, well, you know, I want to keep this post public. I want to keep this one archived. I want to make it so that I only see this one, but other ones people can see. And it's more granular control. And I think what's going to be interesting is to see how people use it, because honestly, one of the biggest problems people are having now that we have an entire generation of people who grew up on Facebook, is that as they're applying to colleges and jobs, we've been hearing about how they lose their job, their college acceptances, or they end up not getting a job because the people checked out their Facebook profiles and said, oh my gosh, I can't hire or allow this person into my school. And that's going to be what's really interesting. And also it's worth noting, Facebook's been struggling, according to reports, with getting people to post more. Believe it or not, it's actually been going down. Yeah. And that is something that, you know, if you feel like you have more control over it, even though I have to remind everyone, the internet is forever. Whenever you post anything, it's not going to go away. But making people feel more comfortable might encourage them to post more.
What do you make of these services that advertise they'll purge your digital record for this very reason? Are those worth the money?
Depends on who you are and what you need it for. So that what those services tend to do, and it's not all of them, just some of them, is that they tend to create a bunch of other stuff on the internet. So they'll create websites that talk about all the good stuff you do. So for a politician, for example, who may have done a lot of bad stuff, you know, hiring one of these services, you can't get rid of the news articles that were written about them or the bad photos, but you can try and kind of obfuscate it by putting up a bunch of good stuff. And that's what these services tend to do. They can't stop the bad stuff from being there.
Our Anna Devlantis, I was just talking about this, is going to talk later this afternoon after 1 o'clock about the corporate involvement in the George Floyd issues. Talk a little bit about that and what tech companies or companies in general are doing.
Yeah, tech companies are really getting involved, and it's been rather interesting because over the last 4 or 5 years, we've really seen tech industry kind of exercise its muscle a little more and get involved in social issues in a way we really hadn't seen. Before that, they would talk every once in a while about, like, H-1B visas and stuff that related to the tech industry. But now, you know, ever since really Donald Trump has become president and we've seen stuff like the travel bans and whatnot, the tech industry's been increasingly speaking out. So in this case, we've seen all sorts of people from Facebook committing $10 million to various social groups, to Amazon pledging money to social justice groups. Google said that it will support their various groups as well. So all of these companies are not just putting out these posts where they put up a black screen and a bunch of text. They're actually throwing money at the problem. Granted, all these companies are also some of the richest in the world, and they're giving just a fraction of the profit they make per day, but it's something.
So then there's Facebook, and they did not take down the president's post that I guess he also tweeted, but Twitter took action. Settle that score for me. What's going on there?
There's a lot of pressure on Facebook, and particularly Mark Zuckerberg, the CEO. He has said that he believes it's most important that people see what public figures have to say. And I think what's been interesting is that increasingly people like companies like Twitter, and now Snapchat as well, by the way, have decided that when there's a perceived call to violence or there's a imminent threat to toward individual people, it crosses a line. And by the way, one of the more interesting things I've seen on Twitter lately was that someone created a Twitter account where they basically just copy-pasted everything the president wrote in his Twitters and wanted to see how long before Twitter would take it down, because there's this argument that a lot of people have that the president has different rules for him on Twitter than the rest of us. And sure enough, it only lasted a couple of days before it violated Twitter's rules. So I think that it's going to be interesting to see how Facebook ends up ultimately responding to this. The employees are starting to speak out publicly and saying they disagree with allowing the post to remain up. They want something to be done to show that the company doesn't support what Donald Trump has been posting. And I think it's really a turning point for the tech industry where they've decided it's no longer just allowing anything to happen on their platform. They really want to speak out and say when they think things are wrong.
The president said that when he said the shooting starts, when the looting starts, the shooting starts, that wasn't a prescription by him. It was rather just a reflection of what tends to happen. And he said he didn't even know the genesis of that saying. He's heard a lot of people say it, he said, and that it's just a fact of life. So I believe that was what Zuckerberg also referred to when he said that they didn't take it down, not because he was suggesting people do that, but rather that's what you tend to see. Is that a fair description of what happened there, Ian?
I think that's what Mark Zuckerberg is saying. And I think what the problem is that, you know, that when you look at a lot of the tweets that have been put out by the president in particular, and the response that have happened and people pushing back on them in two tech companies, oftentimes when they've crossed a line, the president has come back and said, oh, I didn't mean it that way. Oh, I didn't know it meant that.
Yeah, right.
And it's kind of become, you know, the tech industry and a lot of the employees are saying, well, we're sick of this. You know, we don't want to be a place that is a platform for potential violence, whether real or perceived. And I think that that's part of the problem. I don't think it matters anymore what the president meant to say, because there's so many times that he's gone out a couple of days later, not immediately, mind you, a couple of days later, and said, oh, I didn't actually mean it that way.
Problem is especially acute, I would suggest, for Twitter, because like him or not, he's good for Twitter. People go to see what the president said with his tweets. Twitter must benefit from that, even if they don't agree with what he's saying.
And I think that's an issue that the entire tech industry is grappling with, is that as the world becomes more reliant on tech industry and using these tools, you know, these companies make money largely through advertising, right? Our eyeballs are what make them money. And as you mentioned, like it or not, the president's tweets do mean more advertising and eyeballs. But I think what's happening is that these companies have become so rich and so powerful that they've decided that they are willing to fight that battle and say, you know what, we're going to stand for what we believe in, at least in some cases, whereas before they may have cowered before the concern that their money would dry up.
Well, I'm not sure they're being that bold in their defense yet, but I did notice that they also, did they take down Matt Gaetz's glorifying violence post?
The same case happened here, where what happened was that he posted that one, and you can look up the history of that tweet on CNET. But in that case, what happened was that they Twitter added this overlay. So just like with the president's tweet about the looting starts, the shooting starts, it actually was not deleted. There's just an overlay on it saying, hey, this tweet violated our rules, and in most cases we would have removed it. But because it's from a public official, we're leaving it up, and if you want to read it, click here. And that's what they did to Matt Gaetz's as well.
Which almost guarantees that it's going to get even more hits, and that's the conundrum for them. I'm interested in that conversation, and I don't think it's easy to decide if this congressman or the president say something, were it anybody else, that wouldn't be tolerated, but in this case, we will. I think there's something to that position, right? They aren't anybody else. They wield more influence. Maybe we ought to know what they're thinking, right?
It's a challenge. It really is. And I think that we're going to be dealing with this for quite a while. You know, I've been personally tracking a lot of the violence that's been happening toward journalists. over the last couple of weeks. And I'm not alone. The SPJ and a bunch of other journalistic organizations have been talking about how it's extraordinary that journalists are being attacked by the police during this time. And one of the things that people have pointed to is that the president often tweets the press is the enemy of the people. And the question becomes, is that influencing that type of behavior? Whereas for many years and many decades, the police were not attacking the press as much as they are now. So I think that's part of the challenge that Twitter and Facebook have, is that, you know, at one point words have impact, and the question is, when do they feel like they need to pull back, and when the person who's tweeting isn't pulling back themselves?
You said the police attacking the press. The people attack the press, too. Journalists that go to rallies where people are wearing face masks themselves get assaulted because they're wearing a face mask. Different subject. Uber will is Uber going to do this? Rather than paying a fee per ride, I can get the use. Well, now, I would be able to get the use of one of their vehicles or be driven around for $50 an hour. Is that a flat fee, and how is that different than what they've done in the past?
Yeah, so this is a flat fee service. It's really fascinating. What they want to do is that, you know, Uber, of course, has been decimated by the coronavirus. I mean, we've seen them go through layoffs, and we've seen them really struggle. And the Uber drivers as well have struggled because that's their business for some of them. And now the company is coming up with all these different ways to try and make money. So they have Uber Eats, where you can get food delivered to you. That's very helpful during this time. There's also, they have a package delivery service. So they'll actually, like, if you're a lawyer and you need to get a document across town, you can now hire an Uber to do that. But also now they have this hourly booking thing where you can book an Uber for $50 per hour up to 7 hours at a time to take you around the city. And by the way, it won't take you outside the city. So, you know, if you want to go from Chicago to Wisconsin or something, it's not going to happen. But they will take you around a certain metro area. And it's really intended for people, you know, think of the elderly who have many different things they have to do, right? They've got, you know, maybe I have to go to the post office and I have to get some groceries and then I need to go to the doctor. You can hire the same car to do all that instead of having to hire a bunch of different Ubers to do it.
That's always been a frustration to me. What if I got to go two places? Essentially, that's two separate bookings. I'm sitting right here. I've literally seen or heard stories where people got to get out of the car and start all over again, which is crazy.
Yes.
Boy, they should have thought of this a long time ago, but good for them.
Well,
that
see if
they
it
did.
Works, right? Yeah. That's the question, is whether people really want it.
Ian Schur, editor-at-large, CNET.com. Thanks, Ian.
Thanks for having me.
It's 12:30. This is WGN. Elise Glink has a few things to say on the real estate and business front. Amy Guth talks about food that Americans need. At 12:33, you're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN. I'm John Williams. I said Amy Guth was going to talk about food insecurity. We'll ask Elise Glink, actually, to do that in just a minute. Elise Glink, the real estate and financial wellness expert. You can find her stuff at thinkglink.com, thinkglink.com. Hi, Elise. How are you?
Hi, John. Good, thank you.
I want to start with the jobless claims, though. Let's just follow the numbers first here. Where are we? What's going on?
Well, the total unemployment numbers came in a little bit worse than expected. I think there was some excitement earlier this week when ADP released their numbers that said that only 2.8 million people lost their jobs in all of the month of May. I know I was confused given that per week we're seeing just about that over the course of May. But when you look at weekly jobless claims announced this morning, it was 1.877 million last week, plus another 600,000 people who are self-employed who also filed for unemployment. So that was worse than they expected.
And so the unemployment rate then, last we spoke about this, was, what was it, 19.5%? Is it 20.5%? Something about that?
Well, it's officially 14.7%, I think, or 14.9%. But the new number comes out, I think, tomorrow. And everybody is expecting that number to come in around 20%. Some people are projecting as high as 22%. But I want to remind everybody that that number doesn't completely reflect everything going on, because that number doesn't include things like people who are self-employed who are now unemployed, and other people who don't count for a variety of reasons in that official number. And in fact, so if you look at where we were last month, 14.9, let's say, the U6, which is the total measure of unemployment, is already at 22%. So I'm expecting the numbers tomorrow to come in around at least 20% for the official number and maybe even close to 30% for this U6 larger measure.
Why do they call it U6?
I don't know. It's U1, U2, U3, up to U6. U6 total measure. I really don't know where the numbering system came from.
I'm also interested in how long people will be unemployed, right? Like we were talking with Terry Savage yesterday about, have we hit the peak of unemployment? Have we hit the peak of, say, new COVID infections? Is the market bottomed out for good? We're all interested in where we are on these rides that we really can't tell what the future is. But I guess it's not just how many people are unemployed. Say the number stabilizes, but then how long before those unemployed people, if the number doesn't go up, how long before that number goes down? That's, I suppose, as vital as anything.
Sure. We call that continuing claims. So it's the weekly continued claims for unemployment insurance, or how long people are requesting uninsured. You know, they have to prove that they're still unemployed. So last week there was some excitement around that number because for the first time since this all began, the number dropped from around 25 million for continued claims down to about, say, 21 million. So the number, that seemed really good. But this week, it rose again by almost 650,000, which was quite a bit worse than Wall Street expected. They expected that number to go down, and instead it's going up. I'm still hearing about people getting laid off. And in fact, today, another company laid off its entire marketing group. And you just really have to feel for people who are just processing this news. And then finally, the last group of people who we also have to really feel sorry for are the people who filed for unemployment, but their claims haven't been processed yet. And there are plenty of people, millions of people who fall into that bucket. And some people are waiting as long as 40 days to get their unemployment checks, which kind of leads us nicely into why I think the number of people who are food insecure or going hungry is rising.
You're looking at what percentage of people or how many people?
Well, how many people are not getting their claims or how many people are hungry?
Hungry. I'm onto the food now.
All right. Well, lunchtime, right? So 26%, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation, 26% of Americans say that they are experiencing either smaller meals because there wasn't enough money to buy enough food, they visited a food bank, or they've applied to receive benefits from the federal SNAP program. And that is just extraordinary.
It's funny, isn't it? Because funny's the wrong word. But so you have that. And then at the same time, you have people on social media saying, here's what I'm doing, eating, because we're bored. We got nothing else to do and we're staying in. It looks like there's the haves and the have nots. And that 26% is really an astonishing number.
You know, for everybody who says to me, is it really that 40% of Americans don't even have $400 in savings? Or is it really true that over 70% of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck? This is, to me, the proof in the pudding, no pun intended, because if you've got 26% of people who are, you know, skipping meals or going to a food bank or applying for federal SNAP benefits, which is that's not an easy task anyway, applying for that program. I mean, that's a real sign that you're in trouble. And we've seen reports, you know, throughout this whole pandemic about the miles of people in all sorts of cars, Mercedes on down, who are in line waiting for those food pantry staples.
I think
the answer is true.
Yeah. Is this an argument then for another round of stimulus?
Well, I think you're getting close to needing that, and we're going to have to see how it all plays out. So just to keep everybody in mind, the extra $600 on top of your regular unemployment benefits, that lasts till July 31st. And I think there's going to be a real look at how many people are going back to work by then, whether we can get more through, and how it needs to be distributed. The Senate passed today a clarification of the Paycheck Protection Program rules, which now allow small businesses who got the PPP to be able to spend it over a longer period of time rather than having to get everything done and paid for within 60 days. For some people, that 60 days is up now. They haven't even been able, if it was a restaurant, they haven't even been able to bring their people back, and they're supposed to spend 75% of that money on salaries. Well, they just haven't been able to, so they're expanding that. Look for news about that tomorrow.
And both the stimulus $1,200 and the unemployment benefits that people are due are not, as you said, fully been dispersed. They've been appropriated, but banks or the governments of the state and the federal government have actually not gotten all of the money out. I believe the number was 1 in 20%. Terry Savage said yesterday of the people in Illinois due unemployment compensation still have not received it, which is sad.
Well, think about all the people who are trying to make their rent payments, right? A lot of people who didn't receive it and couldn't afford things and had mortgages got mortgage forbearance. People with rent, not so much. And there's, you know, obviously there's a real struggle going on right now to whether you pay your rent, do you buy your prescription medicines, you're out of a job, so what do you do about health insurance? And if you've got people who are sick and you can't afford COBRA, these are real struggles that a significant amount of people in this country are facing right now, and it's heartbreaking, John.
Rita Lise Glink, real estate financial wellness expert, the owner of Think Glink Media and Best Money Moves. You'll find her at thinkglink.com. Thanks, Elise.
You bet.
Okay, it's 12:41. Here's the Wintrust Business Minute.
Wind the clock. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, your daily roundup of Chicago area business news. Binney's Beverage Depot saw 11 of its 42 stores damaged during the recent protest. They're still trying to decide when they'll reopen, but they say they will reopen all stores. They say they work hard to build deep relationships with their neighborhoods. Grubhub and DoorDash have temporarily stopped deliveries in parts of Chicago and other cities during the protest. Grubhub was already facing challenges over some of its fees it charges restaurants. Chicago and New York are Grubhub's largest markets. And Chicago Inno says researchers at Northwestern University have received a $200,000 grant from the National Science Foundation to keep working on a wearable device that can catch early signs of coronavirus. The device uses artificial intelligence to detect suspicious coughing or respiratory activity that suggests a patient could be getting sick. That's the Wintrust Business Minute. I'm Steve Bertrand.
Thank you, Steve Bertrand.
The markets are trying to come back. The Dow started to positive territory, then dipped negative. It's still down, but off the low, down 18 points. The NASDAQ off its low at 42 down, and the S&P 500 is down 11.
This is Orion Samuelson with some agribusiness news. Go ahead, O.
The agricultural markets are doing better than Wall Street today. As we look at current prices at the Chicago Board of Trade, the July wheat contract up 12 and a quarter cents a bushel. July corn is up 5 cents a bushel. And July soybeans are trading 12 and three quarter cents a bushel higher. Livestock futures, Chicago Mercantile Exchange, the July lean hog contract up 17 cents a hundredweight. The June live cattle contract is up 17 cents, and the August feeder cattle contract is up 25 cents a hundredweight. Secretary of Agriculture Sonny Perdue today announced the USDA Farmers to Families Food Box Program has distributed more than 5 million food boxes in support of American farmers and families affected by the COVID-19 pandemic. And there's also a program that's available now from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. They've approved more than $545 million in payments to producers who have applied for the Coronavirus Food Assistance Program. And the virus has hurt America's farmers, ranchers, and producers, and the companies that process the items that they produce. Next week, the Illinois State FFA Convention will make history. It will conduct its first ever virtual convention, state convention in Springfield, starting June 19th and continuing through June 11th. The sessions of the Illinois FFA Convention will be available by technology and not in person. We're still getting reports on county fair cancellations because of the COVID-19 situation and other activities as well that we normally see during the summer months, like Harvard Milk Days, normally held the first weekend of June Dairy Month, has been postponed, and it will be held in October. More on that later, but that's Ag Biz. That's your money on 720 WGN.
1247 WGN Radio. John Williams here. Amy Guth is too. Let's talk more business now. Amy's got a handful of stories that caught her eye, and I think yours too. Just real quick, matter of business, the CBOE delays reopening of floors for a week still, huh?
Yeah, that's right. So they had already pushed this back a little bit. They were just kind of in a, like a wait-and-see sort of mode. They had announced earlier, hey, we're going to, like around mid-March, they said, hey, we're going to kind of push this back to June 1st, and then but said, hey, that might change, and then late May said, no, we're going to push it back to June 8th. They delayed that another week for a couple of reasons. One, over the weekend, all the events due to the widespread civic unrest, you know, there wasn't access into the loop, so people couldn't get in and prepare for that. So they're just pushing that back another week. Now, all this is in the middle of some speculation that's been from the start since March, when they were able to successfully shift a lot of traders to working electronically and working remotely. This speculation kicked up, hey, is this going to be kind of the new normal? We were able to really successfully transition to an electronic format. Is this going to be the way? You know, what they're saying right now is that, you know, they don't have any plans to move it like that. But certainly they're going to work with about half the traders on the floor as usual. Part of that is certain companies just want their people to keep working from home. Some of that is they've redesigned the floor to accommodate social distancing. So you're not, you know, picture a trade floor. It's really crowded. There's a lot of chaos. People are right on top of each other. So they're trying to kind of figure out what that kind of new normal is. And I think there's a lot of stories like that today and certainly this week about, you know, how as we've set into reopening into phase three here in the city and on the state level, how are people accommodating that? What are we doing? How are we working around these kind of things into the moment that we're in?
Boy, you talk about not wanting to go to church. I know you want to go to church, but that's an unhealthy environment with COVID, as are small classrooms, all of those confined areas, as are maybe L cars, but the Board of Trade floor would be the very worst kind of scene, right? I mean, it's people exhaling a lot in each other's company. If one person is sick, I can see why they would want to, why they would not want to rush back to that location.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, exactly. Like, it's exactly how you can imagine a trade floor. It is people shouting in really close proximity to each other. It's really, like, not as it existed anyway, not really where you'd want to be trying to avoid any kind of viral outbreak. So, I think a lot of people are relieved to see they've rethought and kind of reconfigured what that looks like. But then this kind of the second delay was really about, hey, downtown was inaccessible. We couldn't get there. So it's kind of these two issues converging on, you know, both the civic unrest and the pandemic converging on CBOE to mess with the timeline. And we'll see what that looks like going forward. I mean, you know, despite the assurances that, hey, no, we're not moving to electronic trading, I think a lot of things are going to be in a wait-and-see mode, you know, perhaps as the floor opens and it's only about half full of what it used to, and what it used to be, and some companies are working remotely. There might be some kind of advantage. There might even be a cost savings for real estate-wise. You know, maybe companies are going to maybe need less space, things like that. So those are the things that I think will be really interesting to watch moving forward as reopening happens, as people settle in and say, well, what do we really need? And let's take this moment to kind of rethink what's possible and what we really need to do our work well.
Amy, has that violence also curtailed the business for the Uber Eats and DoorDash and stuff like that?
Yeah, so those companies have Grubhub, DoorDash, Uber Eats, all of those. They have made some pauses. Some of those are about curfews because you don't necessarily want, you know, your delivery drivers out there after curfew to be in the way of anything or potentially, you know, scuffle with law enforcement or just disobeying curfew. That's part of it. Some of it is there was just accessibility issues. You know, if there's a protest area and police are blocking off streets or trying to send protesters one direction, it's really hard to say, hey, but let me through. I'm trying to deliver this food, right? So they were just kind of shutting down, and they're pretty big swaths. They were letting their letting their drivers know, you know, there were certain areas they weren't going to, they're, you know, we're just not going to serve this one spot, things like that. So, you know, a DoorDash spokesperson said it's all about, you know, the health and safety of our community, of our people doing the deliveries. We want everybody to be, you know, that's going to be top priority. And they're really just kind of working with the city to, you know, based on that guidance of, like, where does it make sense to skip and where does it make sense to keep going? You know, New York and Chicago are two of the biggest markets for food delivery. So that's, you know, I'm sure at some point we're going to see that reflected in the numbers of what it even, you know, one weekend of no food delivery look like when we saw that number spike so significantly in the second half of March and throughout April and early May. You know, what's that going to look like for their numbers? Wait and see. But, you know, it's again, interesting to see how businesses are kind of having to bob and weave around kind of two converging forces right now.
I didn't see this, but I guess the CDC wants people, when they do start going back out, to drive in their own car. Everybody take a separate car so as to avoid spreading the virus inside vehicles. Is that right?
Right. Yeah, that's right. So, you know, and this has sparked a lot of interesting discussion online. I'm always curious, like, how are people reacting to a story? So I'm often looking, you know, in the comments and looking to see who's sharing the story and what they say. And this was kind of an interesting one because it's a bit of a catch-22. On one hand, hey, don't carpool with people from a different household because that puts you in a tightly confined space, meaning a car, with people from another household where we want you to do social distancing. However, there's been a lot of discussion of, hey, since there are fewer cars on the road, one of the, you know, silver linings, if there is one, is that the air quality is, you know, something we're not maybe as in a dire, you know, we maybe bought ourselves a little bit of time with that. It's not quite as dire. So basically saying everyone drives their own car is inviting a lot more emissions out into the air, into the environment. So some are saying, well, wait, that's a respiratory hazard too. What are we doing here? So it's kind of sparked this really interesting, like endlessly circular debate about, well, do we want the benefit now or later? Both of those things are harmful. What's the plan here? You know, I mean, CDC's job is to keep an eye on the immediate and you know, they're less climate and emissions focused, and although they do concern themselves with issues connected to air quality, they're really about, like, let's get people through this wave of the pandemic and then let's assess what's next. But yeah, that sparked a lot of interesting conversation because, you know, I think a lot of people are feeling certain feelings about being on public transportation. We've all been on a bus or a train with a stranger inches from our
well,
face.
That's the one. I think that's the one.
Time.
I mean,
yeah.
A lot of Americans drive solo anyway, so I know if we don't carpool or take somebody else, okay, fine, that's going to add more cars. I think the problem is going to be people don't want to get on the L.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I've seen a lot of conversation around that, even on this story, as people were sharing it. There's people kind of going like, yeah, but I still don't know that I'm ready to get on a train or a bus at rush hour. It's really crowded. That just seems like a petri dish. So I think figuring out that piece is going to be a big part of reopening, of how, you know, you can open all you want, but until people have a way they're comfortable getting to their offices, I don't know if that's going to get them in the door. So I think that's a really, really big, big piece of that for our public transportation lines to kind of work out.
Right. And it may just be an argument for people to stay at home and work indefinitely, maybe forever. Find some hybrid, maybe where you stagger the shifts. They talk about that for schools as well, so that everybody's not riding together at the same time. I'd like to see the L cars less populated, period. But if everybody's going downtown, we could barely accommodate the flow as it is. I you know, there's no solution to that.
Yeah, I know. And even, you know, there's kind of this narrative arc of, oh, well, maybe it's staggered start time. So we just kind of get rid of rush hour entirely, which is an idea. But there's still, I don't know that you could totally avoid crowds. And that is an enclosed space, which so much of the focus has shifted onto enclosed space. That's why when we're talking about restaurants, it's all about that open air dining, or restaurants that have the ability to kind of open those big windows up front where it looks like there's just no wall there. So, you know, that is a different viral environment than it is, you know, to be in an enclosed space. So, yeah, when we're thinking about our transportation options, yeah, I think that gets kind of icky pretty fast for a lot of people.
All of this goes away if we have an antibody, if we have a vaccine. But
yeah,
we don't have that yet. Amy Guth's always interesting to talk to. Thanks for your time today, Amy.
Thanks so much, John. Have a good one.